Thank you very much, David. I think we have some pretty sharp lines drawn now, and perhaps our third speaker will introduce a middle-of-the-road line. I'm not sure.
There's a hell of a lot of middle between those roads.
Our last member of the panel this afternoon is, as many of you know, the distinguished editor of the Indianapolis News and columnist for National Review magazine, a graduate of Yale University, and has also done graduate work at New York University. And I might add, is also a member of Phi Beta Kappa. He's the co-author of a couple of books, and in his own right, the author of five books, The Liberal Establishment, Revolt on the Campus, The Politics of Surrender, The Lawbreakers, and The Future of Conservatism. He is also a four-time winner of Freedom's Foundation medals and has been cited by the National Headliners Club for consistently outstanding editorial pages. It is with great pleasure I give you Mr. Stan Evans.
As Dwight Eisenhower said, I think that in most such controversies, the truth lies somewhere between the two extremes. I'm aware that in addressing a group such as this one, that use of the seemingly innocent phrase, lessons from the past, is to become embroiled in endless controversy, because the words convey a number of possible meanings depending upon who uses them and to whom they are addressed. What past, after all, are we talking about? And in what disciplines, concerning what problems, are we intended to learn our lessons? This afternoon, and indeed generally in the dialogue of the conservative movement, so-called, in America, two different kinds of emphasis have been suggested by way of possible answer. On the one hand, there is an outlook which is profoundly religious in its orientation and which stresses the rule of a higher law, the idea of ethical order, and the necessary requirements of effective political authority. On the other hand, there is the outlook which stresses the liberty of the person, the need to assess our institutions in rational terms, the demand for a sharp reduction in the powers of government, and the productive efficiency of the market economy. These two sorts of opinion are generally considered incompatible. My argument is that they are fully congruent, that in theoretical, historical, and practical terms, they are not merely compatible, but integrally related, and that it is from the consideration of their mutual relations that we can best approach an understanding of our subject. The nature of this mutual reliance may be suggested if we consider the complaint so often lodged against the traditionalist approach to political questions, namely that mere tradition or mere precedent as such can tell us little, because there are, after all, many traditions in the world and precedents for virtually anything. Therefore, it is concluded, our standard of reckoning must be not tradition, but the use of reason, QED. Insofar as it undercuts the merely traditional, this position is correct. A political position which accepted no criteria of judgment except what is or what has been would be reduced to an ancestral stasis or a blind sanctioning of existent power, and would be incapable of judging between one tradition and the next. Traditionalism itself cannot answer the question, what tradition, and other considerations must therefore be brought to bear. Precisely the same criticism, however, may be focused upon the idea of an autonomous intellection. Just as we may legitimately ask, what tradition, so may we inquire, whose reason? If our standard is to be what works on principles of rational analysis, we must have some answer to the question, works in terms of what? And the final answer to that question must be a value assumption, which reason itself cannot supply. If we examine even the most successful of the scientific defenses of freedom, that attempted by the classical liberals, we may observe this quite plainly. In this conspectus, freedom is good because it leads on to maximum efficiency, maximum prosperity for the largest number of people. And this was the standard implicit, I think, in the very interesting address given by Mr. Friedman. And I might say that in his discussion, I, for one, found much food for thought, and I am willing to discuss privatizing just about anything if it can be privatized. I think it's a good idea. Although I would say that I think that de facto the institutions he suggests would tend to develop into governments, and indeed the private defense systems would be a kind of feudalism, which, as I'm going to point out a little later, is not necessarily a bad thing. Nevertheless, the question we have to ask ourselves in this kind of discussion, the justification of freedom by its efficiency or its productivity, is what justifies the justification? Why should we want prosperity for everyone? Why should we want a more efficient society? Why is this kind of system preferable to one in which a small elite controls everything to its own advantage and impoverishes everyone else? The answer must be a value assumption. It follows that neither reason nor tradition as such can provide the benchmarks of a coherent political philosophy. There must be some ultimate standard which defines and interprets the tradition to which we appeal and establishes the standards of value and intelligibility from which our reason takes its points of reference. It is only in these terms that we can discover what past we are concerned with and what lessons, if any, are to be derived from it. As it happens, the answers to these questions for men of the West are not particularly obscure. For the substantive principles from which our tradition is derived and in terms of which we have oriented our reason are known to each and every one of us. They are the principles of Judeo-Christian theism. It is from the legacy of Western faith, with its insistence upon a transcendent monotheism, that we derive both the emphases we are discussing. Its fixed imperatives of right are the defining principles by which we grasp the essential nature of our tradition. They simultaneously provide the principles of intelligibility and the criteria of right in terms of which we exercise our reason. Now, my contention that biblical monotheism is the source of the religious traditionalist emphasis is not particularly astonishing, obviously, since the essence of this position is precisely to stress the primacy of religious value. But that it is also the source of the libertarian emphasis may be considered somewhat more doubtful, and I should therefore like to dwell for the remainder of my remarks on this point. The first and most obvious political consequence of Judeo-Christian transcendence is a sharp reduction in the scope and power of the political state. In the ancient world, the political authorities were considered sacred, religious figures whose task it was to propitiate the divinities in nature in behalf of the society in its quest for order, and through this intercession to impose a regime of sacred stasis. In the Western view, this idea no longer obtains. The monarch no longer fulfills this role. The secular machinery over which he presides is correspondingly desacralized. He is no longer a god himself, but under God and under God's law. In the Western view, the spiritual law is conceived as entering society through an independent source of awareness, first through the Hebrew prophets, then through the institutionalization of the Christian church. This development made visible the notion of an alternative authority which may be set against the political state, which can pronounce its judgment on the misdeeds of kings and emperors. The spiritual power formerly united with and compounding the political power thus emerges as a limiting principle, a visible and active embodiment of the idea that there is a law that is higher than and other than the political authorities. In metaphysical terms, this change of view provides a new and higher foundation for the classical effort to expound a natural law superior to the rule of unchecked force. Western theism did not, however, deny that the state did have some proper authority. On the contrary, it affirmed the necessity of a secular power to maintain the civil peace, to defend the society from foreign invasion, and to suppress acts of criminal violence. Its task, as Augustine put it, was to maintain the peace of Babylon, which, though not an ultimate good, was a good after its own kind, a good appropriate to our earthly existence. This is the source of our conception of the paradigmatic or order-keeping state, the functions that Mr. Friedman so interestingly discussed. As it reduced the province of government, Western theism simultaneously exalted the status of the individual person. Man was made in this conception in the image of God. He had the imprint of his maker upon him. And he was possessed of an immortal soul which was distinctive to him rather than an emanation from a world soul as in the pagan cosmology. He was conceived as a rational creature, partaking of the rationality which God had imparted to the universe and capable of recognizing the harmonies of its operation. By the reduction of the state, the individual had within him a zone of privacy where compulsion could not avail. It was here that through God's grace, his will could be brought into consonance with the eternal decree. He was called upon to recognize these characteristics in other men as well, as Augustine again stresses, all of whom were God's creatures and were entitled to respect. God's truth was a public truth, a revelation as accessible in its essentials to the lowliest and most humble as to the mighty. It is from these ingredients, I would suggest, that we derive our characteristic Western conception of the individual person, a being who is not only entitled to liberty because of his creaturehood, but is capable of liberty because of his rational participation in a law which transcends the merely secular. He is a being who, in Vogelin's phrase, can be the measure of society because God is the measure of his soul. The points of political substance emerging from the Western view in sum are precisely those which are requisite to freedom. First, affirming the dignity and the rational capabilities of a person and abruptly scaling down the power of the state. It is just these points which distinguish the West from the views which prevailed in antiquity, and I might add, from the essentially neo-pagan view, which has been gaining ascendancy in the modern world. In this sense, to seek out the relation of religious value in Western liberty is to pursue a tautology. For liberty, as we conceive it, is a way of thinking and acting which came to man only with the advent of Western religion, which antiquity had never known and which modernity seems determined to forget. Nor, I might add, is the religious origin of our freedoms simply a matter of affirming general principles. Granted the enormous time span involved by our standards and granted many wrong turnings, it is possible to trace in the growth of Christendom the emergence of particular institutions and governmental practices which translated these large principles of freedom into political specifics. We see this most plainly contrary to the liberal history lesson, which is so prevalent in our time, neither in the Renaissance nor in the Enlightenment, but in the Middle Ages. The fundamental political idea of the medieval period, for which Bracton is perhaps the most notable political spokesman, is the idea of constitutionalism, the idea precisely that the king himself, the supreme political authority itself, is not above the law, is indeed not the law speaking, as the Corpus Juris puts it, but is under God and under the law. Similar formulations may be found in St. Thomas, John of Salisbury, and later medievalists such as Fortescue and Lord Cook. Medieval constitutionalism, attempting grappling with the particular substance of the social order of that day to achieve this idea, was compounded of many elements. Its restraints were supplied in part by the church, in part by the power equilibrium of the feudal order, in still another part by the notion of authority held by covenant and mutual obligation. The sum of these ideas was that there existed in effect a secular analog to the natural law, imposing practical as well as theoretical limits on what could be done by the supreme political authority. It should be understood, of course, that this constitutionalism is not the same thing as Christian natural law, but a necessarily imperfect effort to establish government on what were conceived to be its proper foundations. On the one hand, to bestow upon it sufficient authority to preserve the peace, and on the other hand, to ensure that government itself be kept within its proper bounds. Through the gradual working out of these ideas and their quite vivid expression by the libertarian theorists of the Reformation and Counter-Reformation, most notably Hooker, the Jesuits, and the author of the Vindicia Contra Tyrannis, we see the elements of a libertarian order being formed, a working federalism, government as covenant, which modern society translates in secular terms as social contract, representative institutions, guarantees of specific liberties in written documents, and so forth. To take but a single example, we may note the fashion in which this double emphasis on the need for law and the need for restraint on those who exercise power produced our own conception of a free and balanced and limited government. The workings of the feudal regime clearly suggested that the best way to keep power in line was to oppose to it a countervailing power. This principle is regularized for us in St. Thomas, and subsequently in Calvin and in the Vindicia. Consulting these authorities, we find a very clear notion of the way in which the state may achieve a proper equipoise of its functions, in which it may defend against outbreaks of private violence and yet be limited. The answer is, in its simplest terms, the formal counterpoise of several different types of political power. Both St. Thomas and the Vindicia tell us that the private citizens should not undertake to violate the law, because if this were the case, then any individual could overturn the existing system. But that this task of resistance should be undertaken against the monarch or anyone who abuses power by other elements of political authority in the realm, subsidiary magistrates and estates. Nor in this discussion of the secular libertarian values which have been produced by the Western tradition should we neglect the market economy itself. In considerable measure, the market is correlative to the reduction in the power of the state, so that as the authority of government is reduced in the manner that we find described in Fortescue, the market and its attendant prosperity quite naturally tend to arise. But there are other elements in the Western religious heritage which contribute to this development as well. There was, to begin with, the fact that the Western view did not disparage the claims of the material order, as many of the ancient religions did. Man has the primary spiritual side of his nature, but he also has a fleshly side, and there is nothing intrinsically evil about this fleshly being and its needs. The evil consists in elevating this secular principle, or indeed any secular principle, above all else. In the second place, there was the fact that the Western idea of a rational being confronting an intelligible creation gave man an active sense of command over the materials of his earthly existence. To this was conjoined his progressive sense, the idea of linear time, which has a beginning and an end, and along which progressive movement becomes possible. This conception, too, is in sharp contrast to the ancient world, which held essentially to a cyclical view, which is revived in Nietzsche in the form of the eternal recurrence. Finally, there is the distinctively Western notion contributing to the rise of the market economy of the volitional order arising through the availability of a public truth and the consequent capability of all men to participate in a rational harmony. The first and most immediate application of this view, as it happened, was in the realm of politics, but it carries over as well, as we see quite plainly in Adam Smith, to the realm of economics. Again, a notion quite foreign to antiquity. This is, I would venture to argue, the provenance of our ideas of liberty, And indeed, to the extent we have enjoyed liberty in practice, the provenance of the fact of our liberties. The goals and values which libertarians profess today, and indeed the goals and values of other sorts, humanitarianism, equalitarianism, and so forth, which Western liberals of whatever stripe have attempted to set up on a purely secular basis, are in fact decomposition products of this religious ethic. Unfortunately, as the course of modern history has suggested, these values are not, and I think cannot be, self-sustaining. It is hardly an accident, I would argue, that all of the modern despotisms began from relativist assumptions, denying transcendence and with it denying freedom. Nor is it an accident that our own Western liberals have been moving at somewhat slower pace in the same direction. To deny the religious heritage of the West is to deny both tradition and reason, virtue and liberty, a necessary order and the volitional harmony of the market. If you doubt this, consider almost any contemporary controversy, such as the manufactured hysteria over population growth, and you will find two motives inextricably intertwined. First, denial of fundamental ethical precepts, in this case, the sanctity of life. And simultaneously, denial of the possibility that people can compose their desires into a rational harmony through a system of voluntary exchange. The lessons of the past, as I conceive them then, are these in the realm of politics. First, that our primary political objective ought to be, indeed, to affirm and to protect the dignity of the individual person. Secondly, that to this end, the powers of the state should be reduced as much as possible, and that the state, where it does exist, should be established on an order-keeping foundation as an institution to protect the peace and those things appertaining to it, the most obvious cases being national defense and internal suppression of crime. Third, that to this end, our best effort to approximate the dual intentions of this kind of politics is to place governmental power under the control of a constitution whose powers are interpreted strictly, both in terms of what it affirms and in terms of what it denies. Fourth, that within this constitutional system, we must strive to maintain the balance and equipoise of different kinds of political power. Fifth, that the market economy should be allowed to do its beneficent work in reducing human misery, and that we should strive to improve its performance by whatever means we can to eliminate irrationalities, rigidities, and constrictions which are not necessary to the essential purposes of government and which visit harm on other people and allow one man or group of men to manipulate the whole. Finally, I would conclude by saying not really a sixth point, but a summary point which applies to all of the preceding five. Most importantly, I think that the lesson that recent history suggests to us is that any effort to restore this kind of libertarian government must be founded upon the religious principles from which these opinions are derived. That when we have cut loose from the theology and the metaphysics which gave birth to our liberty, we have tended to lose our liberty as well. Freedom, therefore, I would argue, not only goes with faith, it cannot go on for very long without it. Thank you very much.